We're indeed privileged this first hour to have Brother Tom Ruggiero from Chicago serving us this morning. We look forward to his message that he is entitled, Looking Back to Sodom. Looking Back to Sodom.
Thank you, Brother Mark. Good morning, brethren. I bring you the love and greetings of your brethren in Chicago, and especially my wife, Sister Cheryl. And as I told Brother Michael, I would love to take the entire Chicago Ecclesia and just uproot them and bring them to California. We had 12 inches of snow last week, and the wind chill was below zero there for a few days. So to come to California in January is really a treat. I am not accustomed to changing my own slides during a discourse, so if you see I miss one and I'm reading and I'm behind, just raise your hand or something, because I tend to lose track of the pictures with what I'm saying. So let's start there. I think we've all learned the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in Bible class, and we tend to lose sight of some of the basic stories that we get when we're young in life, but I believe that it's good to go back and review them from time to time, that these are not just children's stories, but they are real life lessons that we can learn no matter where we are in their narrow way. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah is, of course, found in Genesis, the 18th and 19th chapter. In fact, in Genesis 13, you remember that there had been a conflict that had arisen between the herdsmen of Abraham and the herdsmen of his nephew Lot. And so Abraham wanted to keep peace between the two families, and he suggests that they part company. And he says, if thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Abraham gave Lot the first choice of where to live. And when you look over the choices that Lot had, he made a pretty good choice in one respect. In Genesis 13:3, we're told that Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent towards Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Well, to the natural eye, Lot chose the wisest course, because he chose the well-watered plain of the Jordan Valley. In fact, the scriptures say that it was like the garden of the Lord. It was lush and green, comparing it even to the Garden of Eden. Well, after Lot first settled there, of course, you know he had some harsh experiences of being taken captive and all those things that Abraham had to come and bail him out. But in Sodom, while Lot was dwelling in Sodom, three angels appeared to Abraham. First, their mission was to announce the birth of Isaac. You remember the whole scene with Sarah laughing. And then their second point in what they wanted to make to Abraham was that they were going to destroy the city of Sodom. And in Genesis 18:17, we get an insight into the thinking of God along these lines and how he was dealing with Abraham. It says, and the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham the things which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? What seems from this that the Lord felt that he owed Abraham an explanation for what he was going to do with the impending destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And I think one of the reasons is that God knew that Abraham would be deeply affected by what was going to happen. And so he wanted Abraham not just to know what he was going to do, but he wanted Abraham to understand why he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. The reasoning of the Lord here, I believe, is similar to what is happening in the present day harvest. Why has the Lord revealed the time of trouble to his people? Why has he detailed the destructive process that the world is experiencing and that will culminate in the Battle of Armageddon? I think the reason is for the same reason he told Abraham why he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Because we are affected by it. And so that we can understand and be prepared. I think he wants us to stay away from present-day Sodom, just as Abraham wanted. He wanted Abraham to stay away. Jesus said, I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. He reveals his plans and what he's going to do to his people. Genesis 18:21 is also an interesting verse. Now here we have the angel of the Lord talking to Abraham, and he says, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which is come unto me. And if not, I will know. In other words, the angel says, I'm going to go down to Sodom and see if it really is as bad as I've heard. Why did the angel say that? He knew exactly the evil that existed in Sodom and Gomorrah. Why did he and another angel have to go and see for themselves? The whole scene here was done for the benefit of the righteous, so that they would understand the justice of Sodom, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and of course to deal with Lot, who was living there. That sense of justice was really deeply rooted in Abraham. We see it in his mind in verse 24. He says, "If there be 50 righteous, Lord, will you not destroy Sodom for their sake?" And then at the end of verse 25, he says, "Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" Abraham had an inner sense of justice, and the Lord respected that, obviously, because the Lord has even a greater sense of justice of what's right and wrong. He wanted Abraham to understand that this was a just sentence that was going to be carried out on Sodom and Gomorrah. I think we can learn from that. When we look at the world around us, the church systems, all the governments, we too have to understand that their destruction is just, and it's a necessary work. We have to understand that Armageddon, though a fearful and frightful time for mankind, will be for their benefit. Yes, there will be pain and suffering, but the end result of Armageddon will be the healing of the nations. What lies beyond Armageddon? It's like a surgeon who must cut before he can heal. And only when we appreciate the justness of the time of trouble can we realize that we as Christians should not be involved in the political and social reform of society. Not because we don't want reform. We want it as bad as anyone. But because we understand the judgments of the Lord, that the old wineskin cannot be fixed. It has to be replaced. And what it's going to be replaced with will be so much greater than any government or organization that man can possibly devise. In that discussion between God and Abraham, remember, God asked, if there are 50 righteous, then the city should be saved. And then there weren't 50, so he goes down to 45, and then he goes down to 40, 30, and 20, and finally 10. If there were 10 righteous people in Sodom, he suggests that the city should not be destroyed. This is what Brother Russell says about Abraham, and I love this. He says, "It is to his credit that he was unwilling to think of those people as badly as they deserved. Benevolent people generally are pretty sure to err in their judgment on the favorable side when they think of the weaknesses and villainies of their neighbors." Brother, here's a little test. And pretend you don't know about the story of Abraham here, but you were put in Abraham's place, and you were told that this wicked, terrible city was going to be destroyed. What would you do? What would you say? Would you throw up your arms and say, "Oh, great, they deserve to be destroyed. Look how wicked they are"? That reminds me of who was in the belly of the fish, Jonah. Remember, if he was told that Nineveh was going to be destroyed, I think that would have been his reaction, that he would have rejoiced that this wicked city was going to be destroyed. And so the question is, how do you look at the world today? I think that Abraham would have looked at the world today through kind eyes, that he would have been more willing to err on the benevolent side. I think the Lord would much rather have his people be of this generous type, people who are grieved by the sins of others, rather than being thrilled that these evil things are going to be destroyed. Because we know the pain and suffering that this destructive process is going to bring to people that we know, you know, our neighbors and people we're acquainted with in the world. I don't think that we should relish the concept of Armageddon. I think we should accept it as just a necessary work for the healing and blessing of mankind. I think it is so appropriate for the father of faith, the receiver of the great promise, who is one of our great role models, to have benevolence as such a great part of his character. In Genesis 19, we finally see the angels enter Sodom, and they're immediately met by Lot. And I found it interesting that Lot is just as gracious and kind to these strangers as Abraham was. In the story, he bows to them, he implores them to come to his home, and then he prepares a great feast. It's such an unusual reaction to strangers. I don't think any of us in this room would have treated complete strangers as kindly and as benevolently as both Abraham and Lot had done. And I think Lot is reminiscent of the thinking of Abraham here. And maybe the concept of hospitality, the way they were almost overboard here, goes with the idea of a shepherd's life. You know, they lived in the open country generally. Of course, Lot had moved to the city, but his background was with Abraham. And it was a very dangerous place to live, especially for strangers traveling alone who appeared to have no preparations as they journeyed. And so I think that idea of living in the wilderness made them sensitive to the needs of strangers traveling alone. You don't get that same feeling in cities that you do out in the country. I think country people have the same kind of feeling that there's needs in travelers. In the big cities, like most of us live, I think we see something very different. There's a mentality in our society. There's a coldness and a distance in people who live in large cities. For example, if you took a walk, and I can guarantee you this is true because I've done it, if you took a walk in downtown Chicago, you would see the people you pass by have almost no eye contact with one another, and they have little expression on their face because they're on a mission. They're going to their job, and they're doing what they have to do, and they don't care or are concerned with anyone who's walking around them. And first of all, it's because they just don't know each other. I think that's part of the answer. And there's a self-preservation mechanism of just looking straight ahead and not making eye contact with one another. But you know, brethren, someday it's not going to be like that. Someday, people will walk down the streets of cities like Chicago, and they will know everyone they see. Now, it just might be difficult to get anywhere on time because they're going to want to stop and talk and exchange greetings and see how are you doing. But just imagine the streets of the cities like Chicago and New York and L.A. and Paris filled with people who are all friends, who trust one another, and who care for everyone they see going by. That's one of the reasons that man's governments have to go, because they cannot create that type of society because of the fall and sin and selfishness. Man's society tends to be sterile and cold and uncaring. It's the preservation of the fittest, kind of like the evolutionary term. Well, back in the scriptures, in 2 Peter 2, 7 and 8, the Apostle Peter calls Lot just and righteous. Those verses read, "And God delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them and seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds." Did that change? Okay, please change. I can't think of two things at once. Well, the question when I read this that came up in my mind is, if Lot was so righteous and just, and the wickedness of Sodom vexed him so much, why did he live there? Why didn't he follow the example of his uncle Abraham and stay away from a place like that? Well, on reprint 3939, Brother Russell talks about the time when Lot had gone with Abraham into Egypt. And he feels that Lot saw the worldliness of Egypt. And that had a profound effect on Lot, obviously more than it did on Abraham. And Brother Russell asks, what was Lot's failure? And this is what he says. Apparently it was his worldly mindedness, probably his desire to please his wife and his daughters. He should have decided that their moral interests were far above all others and should have marked his course accordingly. And then Brother Russell draws a lesson for us today. He says, "What we do urge is that all the Lord's true people shall seek first, primarily, the will of the Lord, his righteousness, his service. The things that would make for their peace and their everlasting blessing, rather than the things of time and sense and ease and worldly pleasure." Well, I have to tell you, that's difficult to do, isn't it? To choose spiritual things, things that we cannot see or touch or feel, over temporal things that instantly have a pleasing sense to our human nature. And it's especially difficult to do when those around you are not doing it. When we associate people with people whose goals in life are worldly, how can we not be affected by that? How can we seek spirituality if we don't spend time with spiritual people? And of course, that's the logic and reasoning behind the Lord telling us how important it is for us to gather together, to rub off on one another, to have spiritual insight from one another. You can't do it by yourself very well. It was a shame that Lot could not stay with Abraham and be surrounded by the atmosphere that Abraham created. Obviously, Lot did not appreciate the presence of Abraham enough, because had he done so, I think his choice of where to live would have been very different. As Lot entertained his guests, you remember the citizens of Sodom showed their wickedness of heart. This is Genesis 19, 4 through 8. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, Where are the men which came into thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. And Lot went out at the door unto them and shut the door after him, and said, I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters, which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing. For therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. Now there's been a lot of debate regarding exactly what these men of Sodom wanted with the angels. But my opinion, and I think it's scriptural, is that by what they say and by the Lord's disgust with their perversity, that homosexuality was one of the abominations that they committed and wanted to commit here with the angels. In Jude verse 7, we read, Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. So going after strange flesh, wanting to know the men who were Lot's guests, all, in my mind, suggest homosexual desires. Of course, this is one of the sins that is strictly forbidden in the Mosaic Law. In Leviticus 20:13, it says, If a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. And then in addition to this, the Apostle Paul strongly condemns it in Romans 1:26-27. He says, For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one towards another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. Well, I don't know how you can argue against those scriptures. They are so strong that homosexuality is sinful. But the argument might be presented to us that the scriptures really are the Christian standards, that we, at least in this age, should not apply them to the world. But notice what Paul says in the very next verse. This is Romans 1:28. He said, And as they did not choose to possess the knowledge of God, this is talking about the world, God delivered them over to a worthless mind to do improper things, abounding in every iniquity. And so the question comes up, Does the world have a right to practice sin? And I would say no. No one has a right to sin. Adam and Eve did not have a right to sin. That's like asking, does someone have a right to break the law? Do they have the freedom to sin? There's the difference. Yes, God gives them the freedom to sin. It comes with free moral agency. But they practice sin to their own detriment. It's the consequences of sin. And Paul's point is that by sinning, they are choosing not to make God part of their lives. And so I think the scriptural testimony is clear, but then the question is, what do we do about that? Do we go out and campaign against this and other sins that the world commits? And I think the answer there is no. That is not our job. We are called to be sanctified, separated from the world, and not to try to reform it. Again, not because we don't want reform, not because we don't want all forms of sin to stop, but because that's not the age for it yet. Someday those reforms will come in the kingdom, and we pray for that, when mankind will be healed from their sins and their sinful propensities. But we are not called to be involved in the social issues around us, because I think they would take us away from what God would have us do. And I believe that Abraham is the pattern for us here. He avoided the sinful cities of the Jordan Valley, and he stayed away. He stayed in the more isolated regions where he could tend his flocks and raise his family. But he knew they were wrong, and he knew that it was bad for Lot to be there. When Lot was standing at the door of his home trying to convince the men of Sodom to leave his guests alone, he makes a very strange offer. In Genesis 19:8, he offers the men his two virgin daughters, saying, "Do ye to them as is good in your eyes, only unto these men do nothing." Brethren, I have to tell you, I am floored by that. What father in his right mind would have offered his two virgin daughters to a mob of men like this? It is almost incomprehensible that a just man like Lot wouldn't do this. What was he thinking? There's no question that Lot should have tried to protect the angels, but not by offering the mob his two daughters. And I think the point here is that Lot had unwittingly put himself and his family in a compromising situation by coming to Sodom in the first place. I'm sure he never envisioned this scenario happening when he first decided to move there. But it happened because he compromised the principle of sanctification that Abraham lived by. The Lord was merciful to Lot. We see it time and again in this experience. Of course, in verse 10, the angel takes control. Lot, at this point, didn't know that these men were angels, but they were, and they strike the mob with blindness, and that completely deflates the whole situation. And you see, in one verse, a complete reversal of the situation. What a simple resolution to a dilemma that in Lot's mind only moments earlier seemed irreconcilable, out of control, and that could have led to some awful results. How gracious is the Lord in the way he can resolve the seemingly unresolvable problems that some of his people get themselves into. He is gracious when there is a good heart. This is a moment for Lot. You know, Abraham had a similar moment when he first learned that those men telling him about Isaac and the destruction of Sodom were angels. He had that moment of enlightenment that these were not ordinary men. Well, this was the moment for Lot. It was a moment of enlightenment when he realized that there's no danger here because of who these men really are. There's no threat by that mob. And then the angels ask Lot if he has any extended family that would like to come with them before the destruction of Sodom, which they tell him about. And after investigation, there was no one, just him and his three daughters. And so the next morning, it was time for them to leave. Genesis 19:15-16. And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, "Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city." And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. Now, when you read those verses, when I read them, something jumped out at me immediately. And what caught my attention is that phrase, "while he lingered." Why would he linger, knowing that Sodom was about to be destroyed? And I don't know, sometimes we try to figure this out. It doesn't really say. But what I picture is Lot going around his house and saying, "I've got all these things. How am I going to get them out? Maybe I'll have to buy a cart and some mules, and how am I going to do that?" And then the angel grabs him by the hand and says, "Lot, there's no time for that. You can't take your things with you. This city is going to be destroyed, and you stay here, you're going to be destroyed with them." It's amazing that he would linger over those things. Lot believed the angel that Sodom was going to be destroyed, but he didn't have a sense of urgency about it. He lingered. He hesitated. He thought about his possessions, and brethren, it almost cost him his life had not the Lord again shown great mercy on him. Well, the next scene shows that same type of hesitancy in Lot. In verses 17 and 18, we read, "And it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad, that he," the angel, "said, Escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed." Oops. "And Lot said unto him, Oh, not so, my Lord. Behold, now thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, It is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. Well, again. Thank you. I went the other way. Okay. Those are the words that jumped out at me when I read those verses. The angel said, escape for your life. Don't stay on the Jordan plain. Escape to the mountain. And Lot's reaction is, I can't go to the mountain lest some evil take me and I die. Let me go to that little city, Zoar. It's just a small city. I'll be safe there. Well, Zoar was one of the five cities of the Jordan plain. And the angel had specifically said, don't stay on the plain. But Lot was again hesitating to leave everything behind. His connection to the Jordan plain for some reason was so strong that even when the angel said, get out and go to the mountains, he says, well, there's a little city, even though it's on the plain. I'll be safe there. It's almost mind-boggling that he could resist the angel so much. And of course, one aspect of the story we always come to is what happened to Lot's wife. After Lot and his family arrived at Zoar. We're told in verse 24, then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him and she became a pillar of salt. Well, I think it's apparent that it wasn't just Lot who hesitated to leave everything behind. And maybe the Lord's specific punishment on Lot's wife here showed that she did have a great influence on Lot and his decisions. His desire to stay in Zoar and to just hesitate to leave, I think, was strongly influenced by his wife and daughters. Well, there are a number of theories about how the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah actually took place. We have some very strong clues visible in the area even today. The scripture says that brimstone was used. Brimstone is actually sulfur. And sulfur can be found in abundance around the Dead Sea where Sodom and Gomorrah are believed to have existed. Here is a picture of sulfur actually embedded in ash found near the Dead Sea. Another element found in the area that would make the destruction feasible is that brimstone is common in the area. Genesis 14:10, we're told that the valley of Sidon, where the five cities were located, was full of slime pits. And the word for slime literally means bitumen or tar. And as you know, tar and sulfur are very flammable materials. And a third and very important element in the area is that there is a fault in the Earth's crust. Here's a world map showing the tectonic plates that make up the Earth's surface. And of course, those of you in California know all about tectonic plates. The concept of it is that the upper crust of the Earth actually floats on a fluid-like layer beneath it. And the layer beneath the crust is semi-molten, so it's very hot. So there's great heat associated with it. And as matter is heated, it tends to float, and as matter cools, it tends to sink. So there's this constant current that's going on in the substructure under the Earth's surface. And this cooling and heating process causes currents in the fluid, and so this upper crust is actually floating and moving on top. And of course, as you know, again, these plates often grind against one another. And where those plates meet are generally areas of volcanic activity and earthquake areas. And of course, mountains are often produced by the upheaval of the ground as those plates come together. Now, the particular area we're interested in here is right here on the map where the African plate, the one in orange, meets the Arabian plate, the one in yellow. Here's a closer look at that specific area. Now here, notice the line where the plates meet. Go right through the Red Sea, up the Gulf of Aqaba, through Israel, and up into Syria, and back down through Iran. This is the northern end of what is called the Great Rift Valley. In Israel, it forms a Jordan Valley, with mountains on either side. The Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea were all formed due to the depression caused by the two plates. Now, rather than grinding against one another, these two plates are actually moving apart. And geologists describe it as taking taffy. And as you spread taffy apart, right in the center, it gets very thin and it tends to drop. Well, that's what's happening in this area. The plates are moving apart and the center section is dropping. Here is a view of the Sinai Peninsula from space. You can see right where the Rift Valley is on the right there. So I'm pointing here, you won't see that. The Rift Valley passes through the area where Sodom and Gomorrah were located. Now here's an illustration of what's happening in the Jordan Valley. The African and the Arabian plates, again, as I said, are moving away from each other, and the in-between part is sinking. The Dead Sea is sinking even today. And I read that some scientists say that the Dead Sea sinks by, in some areas, as much as 13 inches per year. Now, on a geologic time scale, that is incredibly fast. And that's why we know that the Dead Sea is one of the lowest, is the lowest point on the face of the earth. And as I said, the meeting of these two plates causes earthquakes. And that's probably what happened in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, because there doesn't seem to be any significant volcanic activity, so it was probably an earthquake. And so with the abundance of sulfur and tar in the area, in an earthquake, pressure from beneath could have spewed all that material up into the air, and it could have rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah, appearing to come out of heaven, as the description is. And there's also been debates regarding the exact location of these cities. There are a few prevalent theories as to where Sodom and Gomorrah actually were. One theory suggests that the cities are today under the waters of the southern tip of the Dead Sea, as you see here. Now, the southern end of the Dead Sea is partially separated from the northern part by that small peninsula you see there. And while the deepest part of the northern section of the Dead Sea is over 1,000 feet, the southern end is very, very shallow. It's only 10 to 15 feet deep. There has been some scholarly speculation that at one time the southern end was not part of the Dead Sea, but it was actually part of the Jordan Plain, and where the five cities mentioned in Genesis were located. Notice how this map shows the cities under the water today. In fact, there was a recent expedition by National Geographic, I believe, where they actually sent a small ship underwater to look for these cities, and they couldn't come up with any evidence whatsoever. But that doesn't necessarily disprove it. It just means they couldn't find it. Another theory is that the cities are located on the east side of the Dead Sea, on the Jordanian side. In fact, on a plateau there, there have been five archaeological finds in the area showing that there were five cities on that side of the Jordan. I'm not sure. Archaeologists have found, they found approximately 20,000 tombs dug at that top city called Badidra. Of course, they believe this is the biblical site of Sodom. So there's two theories. A third theory, in 1989, a man by the name of Ron Wyatt was examining some formations along the west side of the Dead Sea, and he claims to have found sulfur balls surrounded by ash. That picture we saw earlier with sulfur embedded in ash was from his website. These were found at all five cities that he claims were the five cities of the Jordan Plain. This is a map of where Mr. Wyatt believes the cities were located. And he specifically located the city of Sodom near what is presently called Mount Sodom. And he believed that the five cities that were earlier found on the east side of the Dead Sea were actually Moabite cities of a later time period and were not the five cities of the Jordan Plain. Well, you see that theories abound regarding the location of the cities of the plain. And maybe the fact that they are so unbelievably destroyed and hard to find today makes the point that God simply destroyed them beyond recognition. The fact that there are natural explanations for how this could have happened still doesn't take away from the miraculous effect of it. It was really a miracle of timing for the Lord. If it was through the volcanic, through the earthquake and the spewing up of all these elements, it was the Lord's judgment that brought these things about. Notice from the scriptural account that there were more than just the two cities of Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed. In Deuteronomy, the 29th chapter, the Lord is warning Israel to obey the law and not walk after the imaginations of their own hearts. And he says in verse 22 and 23, so that the generation to come of your children shall rise up after you shall say when they see the plagues of that land, and the sicknesses which the Lord had laid upon it, and the whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and burning, and it is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath, even all nations shall say, wherefore hath the Lord done thus unto this land? Well, those verses tell us that there were actually four of the five cities on the Jordan Plain that were destroyed. The fifth city, Zoar, would probably have been destroyed had not Lot gone there. I suppose one more. There we go. Okay. You look at the scene of that general area today and you wonder, how could this have ever been like the garden of the Lord? How could this desolate area have once been lush, fertile, wealthy plain? In Ezekiel 16, 49 and 50, we're told the underlying reason for the sins of the five cities. It reads, behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw good. Brethren, it's a reminder to anyone who looks upon that land of the importance that God places on moral purity and unadulterated worship. However it is adulterated, we are to stay away and try to make our worship and service of Him as pure as we can. Jesus used Lot and Sodom as an example of what the conditions would be when the Son of Man would be revealed. In Luke 17, 28 through 33, after comparing His second advent with the days of Noah, He says, in like manner also as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. But on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and sulfur from heaven and destroyed them all. Thus will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let not him who shall be on the roof and his furniture in the house descend to take it away. And in like manner, let not him who shall be in the field turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever may seek to save his life will lose it, and whosoever may lose it shall preserve it. On Reprint 28:57, we read, excuse me, we may consider ourselves justified in considering Lot and his daughters who escaped to be illustrations, whose antitypical lessons would apply to the present day. For as Abraham and his patient waiting represented the faithful, the overcomers, so Lot seems to represent the class in the end of the age, of the present age, who do not walk sufficiently by faith and who seek not chiefly the kingdom and its righteousness, but who for the sake of earthly advantage are quite willing to risk their spiritual interests and the highest interests of their children by choosing fellowship with the world, by commingling to some extent with the world and the flesh and the devil. Such, the apostle tells us, shall be saved so as by fire. Such the Lord illustrates is coming up out of great tribulation. Washing their robes and making them white and eventually obtaining a blessing, but not the chief one. And so the picture of Lot seems to aptly fit the attitude of the great company, doesn't it? His hesitancy to leave Sodom, the angel taking him by the hand and leading him out just before Sodom's destruction, illustrates the dullness of the great company. Even after leaving, his desire to stay in Zoar showed that he still had a connection with city dwelling, that he felt more secure in a city that really wasn't safe for him. He felt more secure there than where the angel and where the Lord would lead him. And finally, we see Lot's wife turning back to Sodom. You know, the way Jesus described her might suggest that it was more than just a brief glance, like we usually think. He says that those in their house should not return back for their possessions. And then immediately he says, remember Lot's wife. And so rather than a quick glance back to the burning city, she may have actually returned intent on saving some of her precious possessions. But brethren, look at the price she paid. And one simple lesson is no worldly possessions that anyone has is of any real value in life. Lot's wife lost her life because she valued things. She wanted them, and she was willing to return to a burning city to find them. This is a difficult question that I would have trouble with. But think for a moment, if you lost everything that you own, except maybe the clothes on your back. I know that would be hard, but what would you do? If it would devastate you, remember Lot's wife and realize that the treasures that God is offering to us, the spiritual life that we have, is worth more than anything we own, because really anything you own is worthless. Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt. And I think God intended that she be a monument to poor choices in life. She stands as an example of people who choose temporal things over spiritual things, because her heart had a total connection to the things that she possessed. Lot's heart was better, but it still hesitated to let go of the things of the world, though eventually he was able to when God took him by the hand. And the lessons we should take from these examples is not to judge our lives, not to judge our happiness, not to make our goals of worldly things by things we possess. And also to understand the Lord's judgments in the harvest, that they are just and that they are good, and that the world needs them in order to be healed. And because of the harvest being such an important time in this age, we should never hesitate to do anything that the Lord asks us to do. And of course, from the story, never to put ourselves or our families in a spiritually compromising position. Brethren, we are all surrounded by temptations every day because they are the standards by which the world uses to judge success. But when you think about these two men, Abraham and Lot, don't think about what they owned. We rarely think of Abraham by the wealth he had. We always connect him to God's promise. And when you look at the two men and you say, well, which one of them was more successful? Well, the answer is easy. It's the one who put real value and real stock in spiritual things, not on city dwelling, not on possessions, and not on things like that. And so the lesson is, may the Lord help us to focus on the true road to prosperity and wealth found only in the ways of God.
Well, thank you, Brother Tom, for those many lessons for us to think about. Looking back to Sodom, we thank you very much for your message. And we'll ask Brother Tom to close this service with prayer.
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for the precious word of truth that you've given to us. We thank you for the examples that we have of both the faithful and those who hesitate to serve thee. Help us, Father, to follow the example of Abraham and others who exhibited such extraordinary faith and wisdom in the way they directed their own lives. We thank you for your guidance. We thank you for your mercy when we fall short, and how kind you are when we make mistakes to lead us back to the right path. We thank you for the gift of thy Son that makes our relationship with thee possible. We love you for all that you do and all that you are. We pray that we can reflect in our own lives and our own characters the fact that we know thee better. We love thee, Father. We ask a blessing on the brethren here and our continued fellowship together. And we pray in Jesus' precious name. Amen.